Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Today, this is the conclusion of my discussion with British author James Hannam on theistic evolution. He wrote a great book, God's Philosophers, showing how in the Middle Ages they did not believe the earth was flat and so on. Really a significant defense of the Christian worldview. And then at the end of an interview about his book, I found out that he believed in theistic evolution. He's not a creationist. He believes in God, but he thinks God used evolution in the Big Bang. So this is the conclusion. We'll talk about butterflies and the Cambrian explosion and so many fascinating topics. It's a great discussion, so let's get right to it. And he is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, and it's better that one would die and the nation be saved. Moses had no idea that any of that prefiguring, that prophecy, was in his record of the Passover event.
So I'm you know far more about the Bible than I do, but it simply seems to me that as a Christian reading Genesis, I have to look at what the experts say, but I also have to look, as you say, at my worldview, my belief in what I've discovered about science, my belief in the kind of God who I think created the universe, and that all leads me to reading the Genesis account as something which is theological and figurative rather than as literal. Although I think on the basis of what you said, that the authors, the human authors of that book, probably they did think that they were writing a factual account.
All right. Now, toward wrapping up, I mentioned that I'd love to go back to your description of men as so different from the rest of life on Earth that it was like a jump. I would like to go back to that. And also, let me ask you this. You mentioned in your email Francis Collins,
yes,
as somebody you really enjoy. And, of course, he's the head of the Human Genome Project.
Yes.
And a book that has been extremely popular here in America is called Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe.
Yes, I've actually read that, too. I read that in America.
Yeah, and one minor observation Behe makes in his book is that when he did a survey of the standard textbooks on microbiology used at U.S. universities, he said when you go to the index, they have virtually no reference to evolution. Virtually no reference. And he argues there's a reason for that. Because when Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, said, well, nature could never make a wheel because a wheel wouldn't function unless it was fully functional. Or nature would never make a magnet because magnets don't help you survive unless they work. And now we find out that so many creatures could read magnets, so to speak, the Earth's magnetic field. There are wheels and gears and the most extraordinary miniature machinery in the world of microbiology. And so when we talk about somebody like Francis Collins, even though he's the head of the Genome Project, the more we learn about DNA, the more impossible it is to come up with a naturalistic explanation for how features would evolve. So I don't see why you'd name Francis as somebody who encourages you in your theistic evolution.
He encourages me primarily because he's a very great and important scientist who is also a dedicated Christian. And it seems to me that I'm not a scientist at all. When there are professionals in the field who are so respected as Francis Collins and Simon Conway Morris over here, who are working in the field of evolution, I respect what they do, and it encourages me that they are Christians who are also evolutionists. It makes me feel, well, hang on, I'm not static.
All right.
Because there are these much, much more impressive guys than me who've come to similar sorts of conclusions.
Who are theistic evolutionists. Let me ask you this. If he was a young Earth creationist, Mm-hmm. Do you think his career would have suffered? Do you think he'd end up being selected to head the Human Genome Project?
I don't know, actually, in how things work over there in America.
It's pretty hostile. Ben Stein, his movie called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, he documents a number of cases. There are so many when extraordinarily qualified, well-published scientists say one thing in favor of intelligent design, for example, they are fired. They're fired from the Smithsonian. They're fired from our major universities. There is complete intolerance in America's scientific community for anyone. Forget about special creation by the God of the Bible. If you just say that you think intelligent design has some merit, your scientific career is over. That's how it works here in America. And so while I admire Francis Collins, his brilliance and his genetic accomplishments, I understand why he's a theistic evolution, because if he said God made us, he'd be out of a job.
Well, it's interesting that I certainly don't need any persuading about the intolerance of atheism. It's something which I write about on my blog quite a lot, and we've had cases. We had somebody who was employed by the Royal Society, and he was a theistic evolutionist, but simply because he said that we have to talk about intelligent design and creationism.
Right.
Just talking about it, even though he didn't believe it, the new atheist Richard Dawkins managed to force him out of his job. So things are pretty intolerant over here too, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is sad. And so wouldn't it be wonderful if we lived in a world where these scientists could freely pursue the evidence wherever it led without fear of being ridiculed and fired? But that's how I interpret when I hear Francis Collins. I put his thoughts through that prism. When you mentioned James Hannum, again, James is the author of God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. And James, you mentioned your blog. Could you tell the audience how to find that?
Well, it's called Quod Libeta. If you Google my name.
And it's spelled...
The website will come up, and you can just link through to the blog there.
And it's spelled...
And there's three or four of us who post on that, and we're all Christians, and we're interested in science, we're interested in biblical studies, we're interested in history, we're interested in politics, and we just talk about things from a Christian point of view, sorts of things that we're all interested in.
Yes, and by the way, when you Google James Hannum in America... And that last name is spelled H-A-N-N-A-M.
James, that's right. Yeah.
James Hannum. So first is jameshannum.com. And the second...
That's my website, yes. And you can link through to the blog. And you can link through to a discussion forum there where we it's not like one of those internet forums where people are allowed to insult each other. We insist that although anyone's welcome, everyone has to stay polite and friendly.
Well, that is great, and the site is jameshannum.com. All right, real quickly, you mentioned that we human beings are such a jump from other creatures on Earth. We have an erect stature, we stand straight and we look to the heavens, our hands, you could have a concert pianist, we could make the machines to go to Mars, our brains are so extraordinary. And this is all vastly beyond the animal species. But, James, for natural selection to work, then it would have to describe everything we see in nature if it's a viable mechanism, if it would work. And three quick things come to mind, like butterflies, giraffes, and just flight. And with a butterfly, you have a caterpillar that spins this cocoon, a chrysalis, and it hangs there inside this cocoon it's spun, and it basically liquefies itself. I mean, little bits of its body end up sort of staying intact. But overall, the world's leading expert on that metamorphosis says that the caterpillar liquefies itself, and then its genetic code takes from that raw material and rebuilds itself into this beautiful creature, a monarch butterfly. I would like to suggest to you, James, that it is not possible to begin that process by any kind of series of mutations where a creature is going to spin a cocoon, be inside of it, liquefy itself, and survive, not one generation, not five or ten, to get to where it perfects this process and can survive. I mean, that is a death knell for any species that decides to liquefy itself.
Well, that sounds true, but if, let's say, caterpillars started off by building their cocoons so that they could hibernate, and then they came out...
Okay, all right. Yeah.
A year later or after the winter or something. In fact, I know they do that because I find them in my greenhouse, their cocoons.
Well, right. And, of course, the ones that didn't do it initially, they would have all died off because they didn't have that advantage to survive. But let's say it hibernates in there. It builds a little nest and it hibernates. And then somewhere along the line, one of them thought, you know, I'd rather fly. I don't like crawling. I'd rather fly. I'm going to liquidate myself now. I'm going to produce enzymes that turn my body into a mushy goo. And then, once I'm a mushy goo, I need the most brilliant, extraordinary, complex series of instructions that boggle the human mind to this day. I need them to happen overnight so that I could be reassembled as a completely different creature that flies in the sky. That, the laws of physics do not have symbolic logic functions. So the laws of physics cannot put together a series of information, a code, to do that, so that that caterpillar could survive its liquidation phase. James, I'd ask you, I don't know what things like this do to you, but I'd ask you to just say, hey, I'm gonna take a couple of these examples and reassess my commitment to Darwinism.
Well, I'm always happy to look at examples, and as I mentioned, I have read Michael Behe's book,
yeah.
And I did very hard about it, but ultimately I decided that he hadn't quite managed to convince me.
Well,
in the case of the butterfly metamorphosizing, I don't find that quite as difficult to understand, I think, or to get my head around, perhaps, as you do. It seems to me that what the caterpillar does by disassembling itself and building itself into another creature is something that we all do when we are first put together, when we come from eggs and sperm and we grow up into babies. And what the caterpillar has managed to do, and it is admittedly a very clever trick.
Yes, now, James,
does that twice.
James, if you could back up from your response for one moment and realize the form it takes. It takes this form. I think there's evidence that that could happen naturally because it does happen. Look, it happens to us. That's not a response.
But I don't know. Because I'm not an expert in the morphology of butterflies, I can't explain how that happens.
Well, you just gave
it. And I do accept that because I'm not a scientist. I'm a historian, which is although I do have a physics degree, that was quite a long time ago. But I do feel that I have been the reading and thinking which I have done has convinced me almost entirely, and that evolution is true. And having accepted evolution, I think that one has to also accept that if God was willing to allow evolution to do what it does, you have to go the whole hog. We can't do the half-baked version that we both dismissed at the beginning of the program, where we allow God to step in and do miracles whenever he can't quite figure something out.
Right, right.
But that doesn't mean that the evolutionist can explain everything.
Well,
more than it means than the physicist can explain how quantum mechanics and relativity can interact.
Mm. I'd put it closer to that they can't explain any of these things. When you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Francis Collins, if I recall, I looked him up when you sent that email, and he's well known for his study of the Burgess Shale.
That Simon Conway Morris, yes.
Yeah, and the intelligent design movement in America that I mentioned, two of their DVDs, Privileged mm-hmm. Planet and Unlocking the Mysteries of Life, they've just put out another DVD about the Cambrian explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And they go through what we have found in the Burgess Shale. And that Cambrian explosion, we now look at it, it amazed Darwin and so many paleontologists. Look at this explosion of life. Look at it. Why is it there? Where are the ancestors? Where are the millions of years that would have been required before that? Now we look at it not only as fossils, but we look at it understanding microbiology as we do, and we see the wild sophistication of the diversity of life at that very beginning. And the Cambrian
explosion. Was it not the case that the Cambrian explosion, and you'll forgive me if I got my numbers wrong, happened, I think, 450 million years ago? Is that the, according to...
Well,
the,
right, according to an old Earth account.
We have evidence that life first evolved almost 3.5 billion years ago. So there's something like 3 billion years of...
Without
microbiological evolution,
without leaving
we get to the Cambrian explosion.
But the reason they call it an explosion is because it's without leaving a trace. For example, 32 orders of mammals, totally separate, without leaving a trace. We have vertebrates coming from invertebrates, supposedly. This is a major design change, without leaving a trace. We have flowering fossils evolve without leaving a trace. Insects, the wildly diverse study of insects, thousands, tens of thousands of species without leaving a trace. So we have an explosion, and I would say, and that's one of the DVDs I'd like to send to you. I'd like to send to you three, Francis, those three, and I think you'll enjoy them.
But, thank you very much. I'm sure I shall.
Well, can I real quickly then mention two others? Giraffes, for example. A giraffe, we go to the Denver Zoo. We look at the giraffes. They're 20 feet tall, thereabouts. A giraffe's heart is 3 feet in diameter because it needs to generate enough blood pressure to get the blood up to his brain. And when a giraffe bends over to take a drink, if his heart beat, it would literally blow up his skull. He would blow up his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a shutoff valve at the top of his neck. When he bends over, the shutoff valve is set so that the heart continues to beat, of course, but those beats don't go into his skull. And then, though, he would pass out from a lack of oxygen. And so there's a reserve at the base of his skull of oxygenated blood, and the gentle pressure and gravity feeds his brain the oxygenated blood while he's bent over to take a drink. And when he lifts his head up, then the valve opens, the reservoir gets replenished, and everything is fine. So that is such a sophisticated system. That's one of millions of systems. Every one is wildly sophisticated. That's one. Now, the giraffes wouldn't know they need to begin to develop that system until their brains are blowing up. You'd have dead giraffes around streams all over the world. And so then you need all these separate components to completely separate of one another begin to develop. But, James, the real kicker is the development doesn't occur in the giraffe's neck. It doesn't occur in the reservoir. It doesn't occur in the skull. The changes, and there's countless thousands of changes just to deal with that, those changes have to occur chemically in a tiny little cell in the DNA nucleus of that cell. And the chemical influence on that information in that genome has absolutely no impact from the giraffe bending over and getting dizzy. There is no feedback mechanism to then change the order of amino acids and his DNA molecule.
But the giraffe's neck doesn't start out that long, and so as its neck gradually gets longer, it requires more and more systems in order to keep itself alive with such a long neck.
Both systems are
developing together. We don't expect to see the finished article simply appearing in one go.
And you don't think that the giraffes who needed this function would end up dying, and they'd be a very poor candidate for survival of the fittest if when they bend over to drink, they pass out?
If it had a very long neck, then without all that system that you say, then it wouldn't last very long. But it didn't have that very long neck
right at
the time, that it didn't have the system that kept it alive.
Right, and by Darwin's system, it wouldn't begin to develop that wildly complex little system until it needed the system to survive. It wouldn't develop it until it needed it. Once it needed it to survive, it's sort of too late.
Because its neck was such that got to the length that when it put its head down, it got slightly dizzy. When it was drinking, so it couldn't get away from predators very quickly, that would be a slight difference, and then you would find that it was able to, at that point, start developing something which meant that it didn't get slightly dizzy. That would mean that it could grow its neck a little bit longer, and then it further developed the more sophisticated machinery it needed to survive with that slightly longer neck. I'm not saying that that's how it works.
It doesn't seem to me a wholly unreasonable prospect. It would have to happen something like that, but if you got slightly dizzy, you started getting slightly dizzy every time you got up in your chair, and then you had a child, is your child going to have a genetic response to you getting slightly dizzy when you got in your chair? Or as another example, if you flapped
your... Well, if I got eaten because I was slightly dizzy and I didn't have children, then that would be a different thing.
That's a conservative process. Natural selection is not a creative process. It's a conservative process. When there are species that can't survive, they die out. It's conservative. But let's say you flapped your arms constantly because you thought that your offspring might develop, you know, sort of arms that are beginning to turn into wings. If we did that, now this is in Darwin's day, Darwin's black box, they didn't understand this germ of DNA. They didn't get it. And they thought this was like a fantasy, like a Lamarckian fantasy, that if you flapped your arms a lot and you had a child, your child's arms would reflect you flapping.
That's true. Although we have, it has been found that in the field of epigenetics, that the environment does seem to have a little bit more of an effect on the genome than had been thought until very recently, indeed.
That is absolutely true. And the environment's effect on the genome is overwhelming evidence of a programmed response. Like if you have a fish in a lake and you introduce a predator, it's not a million years later, but the next generation, the fish lay more eggs, and those eggs mature to adulthood more quickly. That's in the next generation. That is evidence not of trial and error and survival of the fittest, but the DNA of that species of fish was programmed to change their reproduction when a predator is around. You remove the predator, and the fish begins to lay fewer eggs, and their young take longer to mature. So that in no way is evidence that Lamarck was right. In fact, we now know Lamarck was wrong.
It certainly isn't evidence that Lamarck was right. That's true. But it does show that the theory of evolution is not complete yet, even as far as scientists are concerned. Things which they thought were completely done and dusted, they turn out not to be right. And I'm sorry, Bob, I'm half past 11 at night here in England, so much as I'd love to continue talking to you.
Yeah, no, James, absolutely. I've taken advantage of how gracious you are. Thank you, James Hannum.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been great to talk to you.
You're very welcome. That was James Hannum. His book is God's Philosophers, How the Medieval World Laid the Foundations of Modern Science. The last comment I was going to make to James had to do with wings, the development of flight, but we mentioned Lamarck and this idea that, for example, if you stretch a lot, when you get married and you have children, you reproduce, will your children be taller because you stretched a lot? Remember that Greek god Procrustes? Remember that in Greek mythology? He was the stretcher. There's a bed and you get stretched to fit the bed. Remember that? Well, if somebody stretches a lot, then they have kids. Are their kids taller? No. Genetic science, modern science, has told us that this is simply not true. These things don't happen because when you stretch, that doesn't change the information content in your DNA. It just doesn't change it. And so a giraffe stretching his neck, if a giraffe stretched his neck to eat the leaves higher up in the tree, he's not going to have a baby giraffe with a longer neck. I mean, that is the opposite of science and reason from what we've learned today. That was Darwin's black box. That was Lamarck. That's when they didn't know. And so it's fun to think through and to be able to show the failure of these illustrations and these icons of evolution, how they break down, they don't work. And so then with wings, that was going to be my last example to James. We're told that flight evolved from creatures, whether insects or reptiles, that crawled around on the ground, and they evolved flight. How? Well, there are plenty of science textbooks in America that have given this example, that you have some kind of creature like a squirrel climbing around in a tree, and it's trying to eat bugs, and so it's jumping out of the branches because the bugs are flying, and it wants to eat them, so it's highly motivated to jump. And when it jumps, it stretches out its legs, and eventually it evolves wings. I mean, that is a child's tale. That is mythology. You want to talk about mythology? That's mythology. That is silly. That's the opposite of genetic science. It's the opposite of science. It's a fairy tale. It's a modern fairy tale. What Moses wrote is historically accurate. That is a fairy tale. And why are there flying insects? So we explain the flying squirrels because they're trying to catch the flying insects. That was their motivation for constantly jumping out of trees, high up in trees, and risking their lives to jump. So they had to evolve wings, of all things, as though that's just something that happens in a few generations. Well, how about the insects? What motivated the insects to jump and evolve wings? But then you have legs, and some wings are similar to the rear legs of creatures, and other wings are similar to the front legs of insects or so. But how long would you have really bad legs before you had good wings? You're a species, and you're going to evolve from legs to wings. How long are you going to have, I mean, how many millions of years are you going to have bad legs? You've got a leg that's gradually evolving into a wing. How long will it be a bad leg before it's a good wing? In every step of the way, it has to improve your ability to survive. So now you have legs that are covered with feathers and hollow bones, and they're going to eventually fly in another 10,000 genetic adjustments, but right now they don't. And you've got these lousy legs. You're trying to run on legs that have hollow bones and feathers, and the muscles are no longer designed for running. They're beginning to be designed for flying, except you can't fly. I mean, the whole process is, it's unworkable. But it's a fun discussion, and I appreciate it with James Hannum. Civil discussion on an issue that we disagree with. I believe that the Genesis record is historical, and that the evidence is overwhelming, and that in order to deny that historical record in the Bible, you have to believe things that are the equivalent of fairy tales and fantasies. And Jesus Christ and God's word are way more authoritative than fantasies that we can see deny the very laws of the physical sciences, which supposedly they claim to support. I want to encourage you to go to our website, kgovkgov.com. You could share this show and other programs on all kinds of issues with other people. You could email them shows. You could go to our store, KGov Store, and online look in our science department. We have so many great resources. And Maranatha, what a great school.